It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. Topping the news, President Obama says the framework nuclear deal reached with Iran Thursday could cut off every pathway for it to build a nuclear weapon. Mr. Obama said he's convinced that if the preliminary deal leads to a final comprehensive agreement, it would make the world safer.
Iran will face strict limitations on its program, and Iran has also agreed to the most robust and intrusive inspections.
White House says Mr. Obama telephoned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to assure him that the framework is no way diminishes the U.S. concerns over Iranian sponsorship of terrorism and threats against Israel. Under the deal worked out in Switzerland, Iran would cut its uranium enrichment program in exchange for relief from sanctions that have destroyed its economy. Iran, the U.S., and five other world powers, including Britain, China, France, Russia, and Germany, will now move towards working out the details of the framework into a final deal by a June 30th deadline. Kenyan officials say a day-long siege at a university east of Nairobi left 147 people dead, among four Islamist al-Shabaab terrorists. Police and survivors said the gunmen stormed the campus of Garissa University College on Thursday and opened fire indiscriminately. Security forces surrounded the campus and battled the militants for 15 hours, rescuing more than 500 students trapped by the violence. Al-Shabaab says the attack was revenge for Kenyan military action inside neighboring Somalia, where the Islamist militant group is based. This is VOA News. Gunmen armed with rocket-propelled grenades attacked several military checkpoints in Egypt's northern Sinai Thursday, killing at least 15 soldiers and two civilians. Dozens of others were wounded. There's been no claim of responsibility. Yemeni officials say Shiite Houthi rebels and their allies fought their way through the center of Aden on Thursday and seized the presidential palace and the key southern port city. The capture of Aden, the last remaining stronghold of those backing Yemen's president, Abdel Rabo Mansour Hadi, would mark a setback for the Saudi-led coalition, which has been carrying out airstrikes for more than a week across Yemen. Earlier on Thursday, al-Qaeda militants stormed a prison in southern Yemen and freed 300 inmates. German prosecutors say the co-pilot suspected of deliberately flying a German wings jet into the French Alps, killing 150 on board, searched online for information on suicide and cockpit door security in the days before the crash. Prosecutors say they found information on a computer tablet in the Dusseldorf apartment of 27-year-old Andreas Lubitsch. Meanwhile, searchers at the crash site have recovered the second black box, the flight data recorder with crucial technical information from nearly every instrument on board that plane. Two New York City women have been arrested for allegedly trying to build a homemade bomb to launch a terrorist attack in the United States. A federal criminal complaint was made public on Thursday. VOA's Adam Phillips reports.
The government's formal complaint states that 28-year-old Noel Valences and 31-year-old Asia Siddiqui were in communication with al-Qaeda abroad and had expressed sympathy for the Islamic State, Osama bin Laden, and other jihadists. It alleges the two watched instructional videos for making a homemade bomb to be used in a terrorist attack within the United States. A federal agent who posed as a co-conspirator testified that the pair had already acquired many of the chemicals needed to build a deadly device. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Prosecutors are saying undercover investigators determined the women were plotting to attack police, government, or military targets based on their violent jihadist beliefs. Authorities say the public was never in danger. At least 56 people are dead from a Russian trawler that sank in the Russia's far east in the Sea of Okhotsk. Emergency officials say 63 of the 132 crew members on board the ship were rescued after the boat sank in icy waters near Russia's Kamchatka Peninsula. 13 people are still missing. Get more news by going to our website at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, April 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Al-Shabaab militant siege at Kenya's Garissa University has ended with 147 dead.
This is a moment for everyone throughout the country to be vigilant as we confront and defeat our enemies.
That's Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. South Sudan denies its new visa policy targets diplomats from specific countries. We'll also get reaction from the rebel opposition. A constitutional review conference has ended with a recommendation to make Liberia a Christian nation. And the United Nations says its police unit in Mali used excessive force to put down a demonstration resulting in the death of three people.
It was a grave violation of the United Nations directive on the use of force, and as such, it has to be condemned.
Hervé Lassus is the United Nations peacekeeper in chief. Gweru City Council workers in Zimbabwe demonstrate to demand salaries payment, and experts help to rid countries of landmines and explosives. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Kenyan officials say 147 people are confirmed dead after Al-Shabaab militants attacked a university in the east of the country. VOA's Gabe Jaslow has the latest from Nairobi.
The Somali militant group Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the attack, which began shortly before dawn at Garissa University College. Security officials say gunmen stormed the campus, killing two guards before taking over a section of the residence halls and holding some students hostage. Kenyan military forces battled the militants for most of the day. Kenyan authorities said four of the assailants were killed and one arrested during operations. Interior Secretary Joseph Nkaiserry told reporters in Garissa late Thursday that operations had concluded about 16 hours after the attack began.
The government was on top of this, the security situation in their country. This incident which happened today is one of those incidents which surprised any country.
Kenya's police chief issued a nighttime curfew in four eastern counties, including Garissa, to last for 2 weeks in response to the terror threat. Thursday's attack was deadlier than the 2013 siege on the Westgate shopping mall in Nairobi, when Al-Shabaab gunmen killed 67 people over multiple days. The member of parliament for Garissa Township, Adan Duale, said Kenya will continue to fight against the terrorist group.
We will not be intimidated by access of terror. We will stand united. We will fight them up to the last man. We will take the war to their doorsteps.
In an address to the nation earlier in the day, President Uhuru Kenyatta offered his condolences to the families of victims while urging Kenyans to stay calm.
This is a moment for everyone throughout the country to be vigilant as we confront and defeat our enemies.
The president also announced that he would fast-track the training of 10,000 additional police, saying the country has suffered unnecessarily due to shortage of security personnel. Kenyan authorities have named alleged Al-Shabaab commander Mohamed Mohamud as the mastermind of the attack. A security brief seen by VOA says Mohamud, also known as Gamadere, was a madrasa teacher in Garissa before joining the Somali militant group. Gabe Joselow, VOA News, Nairobi.
The United Nations says members of its police unit in Mali used unauthorized and excessive force when it fatally shot three civilians and wounded four others during a protest in January. UN peacekeeping chief Hervé Lassus says this was a grave violation of UN directive on the use of force. He expressed the United Nations' deepest apologies to the victims and their families.
Now, the conclusion is that members of a MINUSMA foreign police unit used unauthorized and excessive force on civilian protesters. And that, as you know, sadly has resulted in the death by gunfire of three protesters and the injury of four others. It was a grave violation of the United Nations directive on the use of force, and as such, it has to be condemned. And we trust that the individuals responsible will be held fully accountable for their actions. And steps are being taken in this regard in full coordination with the authorities of Mali and the authorities of the police contributing country concerned.
The peacekeepers are from Rwanda, a major UN troop contributor. Lasso said they will be repatriated in a matter of days, and it will be up to the Rwandan government to hold them accountable.
Yes, accountability is definitely something that has to take place. And we have been working very closely, both with the government of Mali, because this happened on Malian territory, and with the authorities of the police contributing country to ensure that the necessary procedures will be undertaken to hold those individuals accountable.
That was UN Peacekeeping Chief Hervé Lasso speaking Thursday at the United Nations. South Sudan's foreign minister says his country has instructed its embassies not to issue visas to diplomatic passport holders without prior approval from his ministry and the Interior Ministry. Barnaba Marau Benjamin denies that the new visa procedure is targeting diplomats from specific countries. He says the process will help South Sudan to provide better services to its important visitors.
So what we have said is that those VIPs with the diplomatic passport, the consul should send them to the Minister of Interior and then pass them on to the Minister of Foreign Affairs. Because these diplomats are coming here, either they want to meet very some important individuals, so we need to have a prior knowledge. They will be issued with the visas with our knowledge so that we can arrange if they are coming to meet the president or a minister or so, then that person will be alerted in time so that if they arrive here, then they do the job they want to come and do.
So my understanding is that this directive is not targeting the members of the Troika.
No, it is not. It is the holders of diplomatic passports who want to come here because sometimes you get an envoy who wants to come and meet the president. If the Minister of Foreign Affairs has no knowledge, if he just lands at the airport and he arrives at the ministry, he may find the president has traveled or the president is already engaged. Now, why would we expose such a VIP to such an inconvenience?
This is coming at a time when your colleague, the Minister of Information and Government spokesperson, told reporters that members of the Troika are not welcome at the negotiation table if the talks resume, because according to Mr. Michael Makui, the Troika members are partisan, they impose sanction on South Sudan, so they cannot be mediators. Is there any connection between that and that this recent development?
That is also a misquotation. Our spokesperson is actually misquoted. And in fact, today, this morning, he had to hold a press conference in order to correct that misquote. Let me read to you what he said. He said the IGAD-led process to resolve the crisis in South Sudan is essentially an IGAD-driven process and must remain so. This mechanism can be further expanded to include other African states as long as the Republic of South Sudan as a sovereign member state of both IGAD and the African Union is consulted. That's normal. Now, he said the role of non-African actors in facilitating the restoration of peace in South Sudan is profoundly appreciated. However, to avoid making the mechanism too unwieldy, the current status of those non-African actors or observers is appropriate and should be retained and continue. The Troika countries have been there since 2013 when the process started.
Barnaba Marau Benjamin is South Sudan's Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation. He was speaking to John Tanza of VOA South Sudan in Focus program. The Sudan People's Liberation Movement, SPLM, in opposition, is criticizing President Salva Kiir's administration for targeting diplomats from some of the countries that it said have been trying to bring peace to South Sudan. Duke Matok, chairman of external relations for the South Sudan rebels, said Juba's decision comes at a bad time.
The government don't have plan to bring peace to South Sudan. These Western developments are making a lot of pressure in order to sign a peace agreement, which I believe this is not the case. They are actually part of mediating teams. They are facilitating the process here in Addis Ababa. They are paying money in order to accommodate and facilitate the negotiations. So we believe that it is very important for the mediating team to move around so that the gap is closed.
What is the importance of the Interior Minister being responsible for issuing the visas? Is this an attempt to control who is coming into the country?
The guy is one of strong men which are against peace in the country. He's a among the guys who instigated the war in the country is one of strong elements from the president area. You know, they have believed that this is their own government. They must have to defend it by all cost. They look into peace process that this is, it will jeopardize their opportunity of ruling the country for a long period.
Where are we now? Has there been any attempt to resume the peace talks?
We are not actually informed about the plan of the ECAT, but let me assure you that we are ready. The SPLM-SPLA is now, the leadership is in Addis Ababa. We are preparing for the consultative meetings, which is going to take place.
Duma Talk is chairman of external relations for the South Sudan Rebels. He was speaking with me from Addis Ababa. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Batty in Washington. Today is Friday, April 3rd, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's give a shout out to listeners on these, our VOA affiliate stations, including Buffalo FM in Monrovia, Liberia, Brela FM in Nigeria, Kisi FM in Tanzania, Capital FM in Blantyre, Malawi, Kira FM in Jinja, Uganda, Radio Lake Victoria in Kisumu, Kenya, Radio Hot Cocoa in Bamenda in Cameroon, and our VOA frequency station in Abidjan, Ivory Coast, and Diamond FM in Tamale, Ghana. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. A four-day-long National Constitutional Review Conference has ended in the central Liberian city of Bangui. A committee charged with reviewing the country's 1986 constitution had been soliciting suggestions from the public for possible amendments. Councillor Gloria Musu-Scott, chairperson of the Constitutional Review Committee, says the process accorded Liberians the opportunity to be part of the remaking of their constitution. She said the delegates approved many of the recommendations, including making Liberia a Christian country.
Several purposes of that. One of them was natural resources rights, that they acknowledge still that government has a right to the natural resources, but whatever income comes from the natural resources, this is benefit directly. The second thing that was approved, that the traditional leaders, the elders, the tribal people, to have the right to own the premises or the land of their ancestors that they have been on for centuries. It should no more be called government land. The next thing that was approved was on women's rights. The constitution should ensure women's participation in governance.
Those are some of the issues. What about the key political ones where people made recommendations on limitation on the number of years that members of the Senate and the House of Representatives can serve?
That is the consensus around that is national, that the number of years the president, the first president, the senator, and the representative should be reduced. That local government authorities, the superintendent, the district commissioner, to be elected, that the chief should be elected, but according to their traditional protocol and procedures.
I read an article suggesting that there was a recommendation of making what, Liberia a Christian nation?
Yes, there was another view from the Muslims and other religions, especially the Muslims, that Liberia should be a secular state, but the Christians, the other side, are saying that Liberia should be a Christian nation.
What did you do about that?
Oh, the vote was taken by the plenary, and the people decided that, and overwhelmingly, the delegates, including the council delegates, overwhelmingly voted for Liberia to be a Christian nation.
For Liberia to be a Christian nation?
Yes, the constitution should declare that.
Given the fact that we have Muslims in Liberia, if it is approved, would that not exclude these people who are Muslims?
Well, the thing about it is that the people decided that this is what they wanted, and this is the outcome of what the people wanted. This is what they voted for, and this is what we are taking forward in our report to our appointing authority, which is put forward to the legislature for its consideration.
Councillor Gloria Musu-Scott is chairperson of Liberia's Constitutional Review Committee. She was speaking with me from the central Liberian city of Bangui.
Scores of Gweru City Council workers Thursday staged a peaceful demonstration demanding payment of outstanding salaries amounting to millions of dollars. Toraya Shava of VOA Zimbabwe Service reports from Gweru, Zimbabwe's Midlands capital.
The workers used their mid-morning break to gather and sing outside council offices in the city, then returned to their various workstations after having been addressed by some of their union leaders. Some of the workers were holding placards criticizing councillors and council management for embarking on too many trips for which they claim allowances and denouncing corruption. Speaking to Studio 7 just after the demonstration, Workers' Union spokesperson Cornelius Elipiwe said the workers had decided to demonstrate to show their unhappiness over numerous grievances, including the fact that a back pay from April to July last year remains unpaid and that council owes them wages and salaries from December.
The background of these demonstrations is that we have an arbitral award which we have won, and it says we are supposed to be given whatever is due for us. So we are only reminding them that we still need our money, and we really need our money because we don't have money to come to work. And we are also saying there has been a serious non-provision of protective clothing. We have some of our colleagues who work directly with sewage every day, but they don't have protective clothing. And we are saying this is very dangerous, especially to their health.
Documents seen by Studio 7 show that council owes workers over $2.6 million in back pay, as well as salaries and wages up to December. Studio 7 was not able to hear from Mayor Amtendi Kombai as he was said to be out of the office. Local authorities across the country have wage and salary arrears running into several millions of dollars. Reporting from Gweru, this is Taurai Shava.
Long after bombs fall silent, the seeds of armed conflict continue to kill civilians in the form of unexploded ordnance and landmines. United Nations correspondent Margaret Bashir looks at how the world's D-miners are teaming up with experts to locate and stop these potential killers.
That's Senna. She's a 9-year-old Belgian Malinois, the dog breed of choice for experts securing areas where there are landmines and unexploded bombs and shells. She's a veteran mine detection dog who sniffed her way across 1.5 million square meters of Afghanistan during 5.5 years working with the U.S. Air Force there. Some 900 dogs like Senna are now working with their handlers in 28 countries affected by mines and explosives. Working as teams, handlers and dogs can clear large areas faster than a human working alone. The Virginia-based Marshall Legacy Institute owns Senna and purchases, trains, and deploys other dogs like her. Most work in the field for up to 6 years. Perry Baltimore is the Institute's executive director.
And we realized very quickly that you're not going to nurture stability, you're not going to help restore hope, you're not going to help promote growth, and you're not going to help alleviate suffering unless you get rid of the mine.
Destruction around the world. In 60 countries, these deadly remains of war kill or maim some 10 people each day, many of them children. Their presence often slows economic development and post-conflict reconstruction because people cannot use the land for homes or agriculture. The landmines can also hinder the delivery of life-saving aid. The UN Mine Action Service, or UNMAS, works in 18 parts of the world to clear, mark, and destroy mines and unexploded ordnance, and then verify that the area is safe for civilians. The UN is also utilizing mine detection dogs, but on a limited basis as it's still very expensive. UNMAS Director Agnes Marcaillot says the detection dogs are an important tool.
We have them in Mali. When we have refugee camps, we walk the dogs around to sniff if somebody brought in explosives. We're walking them at borders. We're walking them in difficult terrain. And we need to continue to do that.
The UN has also used detection dogs in Syria, South Sudan, and Somalia. Senna's handler, Kimberly McCaslin, says despite the dangers, in the past 20 years, only 4 dogs out of more than 500 have been killed in the line of duty. The rest, like Senna, retire to good homes. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
It's 25 minutes past the hour. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with volleyball. Kenya Pipeline and Egypt's El Ahly were stretched to the limit in 5-set encounters before qualifying for the Africa Women's Volleyball Club Championship final in Cairo, Egypt on Thursday. Kenya Pipeline eventually overcame Egypt's Sham by 3-2, while earlier on El Ahly overcame Tunisia's Carthage by 3-2. Tomorrow, in classification encounters, Algeria's GSP Petroleum play Rwanda Revenue Authorities, Uganda's Vision meet Cameroon's FAP, ARSU of Seychelles face Ingies of Cameroon, and Botswana Kutluano play Kenya Commercial Bank. On Sunday, Tunisia's Carthage play Egypt's Sham in the bronze medal playoff before Kenya Pipeline and Egypt's El Ahly square off in the finals. In basketball, the draws for the 2015 Africa Men's Basketball Championship takes place in the Tunisian capital, Tunis, tomorrow Saturday. So far, 13 teams have qualified for the event due in August. These are defending champions Angola, Cape Verde Islands, Cameroon, Egypt, Gabon, Ivory Coast, Nigeria, Mali, Morocco, Uganda, Zimbabwe, and hosts Tunisia. Turning to football, in the latest development, the Court of Arbitration in Sports, CAS, has overturned the ban by the Confederation of African Football, CAF, on Morocco's participation in the 2017 and 2019 Orange Africa Cup of Nations, CAS revealed in Zurich, Switzerland, on Thursday night. CAF imposed the sanction against the Morocco Football Federation after they declined to stage the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations they were scheduled to host, citing fears of the spread of the Ebola virus to Morocco. Equatorial Guinea rescued the event with 50 days' notice to prepare. According to CAS website, the $1 million fine CAF imposed as compensation for financial loss for the sudden change of the competition venue was reduced to $50,000. CAS notes that the compensation fee could still be examined by another jurisdiction. Meanwhile, the draws for the inaugural Africa Beach Soccer Championships in the Seychelles will be staged in Cairo, Egypt on Sunday. Teams that have qualified for the event are Egypt, Ghana, Ivory Coast, Senegal, Madagascar, Morocco, Nigeria, and hosts Seychelles. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omer in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
And thank you, Mark. Have a very good weekend. We'll see you again on Monday. Now, here is our listener mail for this Friday morning, April 3rd.
Please permit me to use this medium to thank Nigerians, especially the security agencies, for the free conduct of the 2 weeks just concluded presidential election. Thank you. Maurice Imagoka, Federal Police Agency, Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Kenyan officials say a day-long siege at a university east of Nairobi is over, leaving 147 people dead, along with four Islamist al-Shabaab terrorists. Police and survivors said the gunmen stormed the campus of Garissa University College on Thursday and opened fire indiscriminately. But some of these students said the attackers were separating the Christians from the Muslims and holding them hostage. And that's it for this Friday, April 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer David Van Dee, reporters Peter Clotin and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Zainab Abdel Rahman, I'm James Butte saying have a nice weekend, Africa.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impuga, coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. Please join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have an in-depth analysis on a topic of news important to you, important to Africa. African journalists and guests who are experts on the topic at hand will share their views, ideas, and expertise in a way that will enlighten us all. So please plan to be close to your radio Thursdays at 17:30 UTC for stimulating discussion and insight on Reporters Roundtable with me, Douglas Impuga, on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America.